The gospel for All Saints Day is traditionally, at least traditionally means it's what I'm used to. It's like the historic lectionary. Which one? Is the Beatitudes in Matthew 5. Now, this is the time of year when I generally go personally into deep despair.
Yeah.
Because All Saints Day, I think in the minds of many moderns, is like purgatory, forgive the phrase, resurrected. The emphasis tends upon the interim state, about which we know actually very little. We know some things. The Bible reveals some things to it, that the souls of dead Christians. Isn't that a jarring phrase? The souls of dead Christians? But that's what they are. Because, yes, their souls are with Christ, but they're still dead. Which is a bad idea, by the way. Death is the opposite of life. The emphasis, I think, in a lot of churches and a lot of Christians' minds just tends to be on that existence of the soul. And that's not the big deal. So anyway, at this point, sometimes I don't want to go to church unless I'm preaching, and then of course I'm guilty of the sin of arrogance, so I guess I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't, so I don't know what to do. I'll probably go to church. But I think you could maybe, as an example, you're mocking me now, but for instance, take the great hymn, the great Norwegian hymn, Behold a Host Arrayed in White. See? Now this is from the vision, I believe it's in Revelation 7, is that right? The vision is at the end of a cycle of seven. So it's a vision of the last day. So the great host, arrayed in white, is John seeing the resurrection. But that's not how people think of it. See? So it's a great hymn. It's all good, but I think we read it through the lens of our sort of semi-Platonic, nasty way of thinking about salvation. I think you could try to get at this. Yes, by the way, we are going to read the text here in a minute. You might be able to get at it by emphasizing that we are one church with those believers, throughout the centuries who have died. That we have a lot more in common with them now. Given their present condition and our present condition, we have a lot more in common with them now than with what will be when Christ returns in glory. So that just as we are waiting, they're still waiting also. I think you can get away with that. I think you can invite the congregation to say, look, now yes, as the hymn says, we feebly struggle, they in glory shine, right? Yet all are one in thee, for all are thine, which is the old wording, which I like better than the newer phrasing. So if you could begin by preaching on All Saints, maybe not begin, but if you could emphasize that, look, we're still a waiting church. Now, they're waiting in safety. They're waiting in the presence of Christ in some strange and wonderful way that we don't fully understand. They're resting from their labors. We're still in the midst of our labors, right? So there are obvious differences with the church triumphant and the church militant. Nevertheless, it's one church. See? And so we are grateful for their safety, and yet together we're still moving toward the great goal of all history and the goal of God's plan in Christ, which is victory over all the powers, over death, and the renewal of the heavens and the earth. So I think if you started that way, if you're preaching or teaching this text, you'd have a fighting chance to get the message across. Now, exegetically, I would just advise against trying to preach on the whole text. There's just too much here. I think you could pick one theme or one feature of it, even one verse. I still remember one of the best sermons I've ever heard on the Beatitudes was preached by Dean Hempelman. I think it was at Call Day or Theological Diploma Service, and he just preached on verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the reign of heaven. So again, I just think there's absolutely so much here. It's, as you may recall, I like to call this the doorway into the Sermon on the Mount. So if you get the Beatitudes right, you're going to read the rest of the sermon right, kind of thing. So at any rate, with all those caveats disclaimers and eschatological emphases, I suppose we could start reading in Matthew 5, verses 1 to 12. So we'll read the whole thing, and maybe we'll come back and do some theology in a way that similar to what Tim did with the Psalm 149. It's very familiar. We almost know what it's supposed to say before it says it. Verse 1, Idonde tus oclus an ebe, eis ta aras, kai kathisintas autu, pras eothan auto hoi mathitai autu. We'll keep going to verse 2. Kai anoixas ta stama autu, et didas gen autus legom. The aorist participle, probably translated temporally, when he had seen the crowds, he being in context Jesus, on ebe, just the aorist, strong aorist indicative of on a bino of all things, he went up into or probably on the mountain. And now we have a genitive absolute that's not absolute because the Jesus occurs elsewhere in the sentence, but the New Testament writers do that. Kathisantas is from kathidzo. It's the aorist participle active, masculine singular genitive. And the referent is autu, genitive. So, genitive absolute. So, him sitting down after he had sat down, the disciples of him approached him. You approach people in the dative. Verse 2, and... now, you could go temporal with anoixas, which is from anoigo, I open. After he had opened his mouth, or maybe just here, kind of the so-called bang-bang or piggyback translation, he opened his mouth and, note the imperfect, edidasken, he began to teach them, saying. This is the first big chunk of teaching in Matthew's Gospel. As you know, there are five large speeches and a couple of smaller ones, right? So I think an inceptive translation of the imperfect is really quite appropriate. He began to teach them, and he's going to teach a whole bunch of stuff in this gospel. So first words out of the mouth of the Son of God in terms of public teaching. Notice the crowds are there, but it's directed to the disciples, who presumably are those who have heard Jesus say, "Repent, for the reign of heaven is at hand." And they've begun to believe it, even though, of course, imperfectly. So his repentant, sort of barely believing disciples, I can say it that way. And then I think we have to say that what comes out of the mouth of Jesus has to be understood as good news, as gospel, right? So maybe we'll just read verse 3 and then we'll pause there. Makarioi hoi ptokoien pneumate hati auton esten he basilea ton uranon. Two emphatic elements in one in each clause. You know, we're used to the King James and everything else that translates that blessed are the poor in spirit. Of course, poor, the poor ones, is the subject of the clause. It's got the article. And you have to supply the verb esten. So the poor in spirit are blessed, italicized, or underlined, right? Emphasis on blessed. Why? Another emphatically fronted element, of them is. The reign of heaven is of them, generally taken to be expressing possession, which is a little awkward, so you have to tweak it a little bit to say, okay, they possess the reign in the sense of the blessing and effects of the reign belong to them. Something like that. Now, just this little adjective, makarioi, I wanted to say something about that. It occurs, I took the notes with me here, here in the Beatitudes, and then four other times in Matthew. Once is the parable of the faithful and sensible slave in 24. Jesus says to Peter, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood did not reveal my identity to you." The other one is in the parables chapter, "Blessed are your eyes because they see and your ears because they hear, for many prophets and wise men long to hear what you hear and didn't," you know. So it's a very strong word. I mean, it really is kind of tantamount to saved. You know, it's not the be happy attitudes, you know. I still remember when parishioner said to me, "Who's Robert Schuller?" And I said, without thinking about it, he's Norman Vincent Peale's illegitimate son. And they thought I was serious, and I had to back up and say, no, I mean theologically, right? This is not the power of positive thinking. Blessed here means saved, right? The best passage of all is 11:6, where Jesus answers the Baptist question, tells him what he's been doing, and then he says, blessed is the one who has not caused to stumble because of me. It doesn't mean you're going to have a nice day. It means that you're getting who the Christ is, right? Oh, and by the way, that was 11:6. And then 11:5, Jesus says, the dead are raised and the poor have good news preached to them. Okay. That's a key parallel to what's going on here. So you could spend the whole sermon, I think, just unpacking verse 3. The poor in spirit, I would suggest, are those who have nothing to offer God. They're the anavim. They're the lowly. They're the ones who are in need. And if this beatitude makes sense to you, then you just are acknowledging who you are in and of yourself. That is, you have nothing to offer. You're in complete, utter dependence upon the provision of the Father of Jesus. Right? So, those who have nothing get everything. And they have it now. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Why? Because God's reign in Jesus and its attendant blessings belong to them. So you could spend your whole sermon making sure that people got that, I think. But we have 12 verses, so we're going to move forward into that. It's such a tough text because I think I remember hearing it preached as a child in the Missouri Synod and growing up. You know, these are virtues. You should be poor. I should be poor in spirit, but I'm not as poor in spirit as I ought to be. See? It's not a virtue, it's a condition. In fact, I would suggest that the first four Beatitudes are like that. Franzmann holds this view, others as well. In the first half of the Beatitudes, Franzmann suggests that the Messiah, I think he has, not surprisingly, a marvelous turn of phrase. I think he says the Messiah speaks his fullness into human emptiness, or something like that. It's a great, now notice that the hutti clauses are important. They give the reason why Jesus can say, blessed are you, blessed are these people. And the first one and the eighth one are present tense. The reign of heaven is theirs. They're identical. The rest of them are future indicative. Right? And it's not the future of the interim state. Tim, I got to do it, brother. I got to do it. I'm not against heaven, but it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that's N.T. Wright. That's his line. They're eschatological, right? And it becomes clear, I think, as we read along. So we'll just read along. The Greek is pretty straightforward. But it only works in a certain worldview. I'll just say it that way. Did I mention that All Saints is a tough time? By the way, I dare you to sing, if you're listening on the internet or here in this room, I dare you to sing, Sing with All the Saints in Glory, and try not to weep. See? Sing with All the Saints in Glory, how does it go? Sing the Resurrection Song. Death and sorrow, earth's sad story to the former days belong. All around the clouds are breaking. Soon the storms of life will cease. I mean, it's a powerful resurrection hymn, and you can sing it on All Saints Day. So, hey, this is not my fault, Tim. I mean, it's not my fault. So, verse 4. Tim and I are reading a lot of language here this week. It's a good week. Verse 4. Those who go on mourning are blessed. Present stem participle, I think, may be significant. So why would that be the case? I mean, you're mourning because of evil and sin, the world's and your own, presumably. Because they themselves, emphatic, you don't need the pronoun there, they themselves will be comforted. Notice the theology of the cross in that. See, the mourning continues. It's okay because of the great hope. And every Christian knows exactly what I mean. Right? Because our lives are like this. Again, it's reversal in light of the promise of the last day. Verse 5, the praes, third declension adjective, it's an odd form, it's what the article helps us parse it as, a nominative plural masculine. Now here's the translation. King James says meek, of course, which sounds very much like a virtue. I would suggest lowly, or even powerless. This is the adjective that is more often than any other used to translate the anavim in the Septuagint. See, the lowly of the land, the humble who need God to save them. See, so blessed are the lowly. Why? Because they themselves will inherit not just the land, but given the eschatological context, the earth. Right? The new heavens and the new earth. And the parallel in Psalm 37 that you see in the margin is precise. I mean, it's a very precise parallel. Verse 6, blessed are those makarioi hoi penontes kai depsontes tein dekaiusinein hatiatoi kortas thesentai. Blessed are those who go on hungering and thirsting after, direct object, righteousness, because they themselves will be satisfied. The righteousness here, you have to ask what it's referring to. There's more than one way to go that would comport with theology, Lutheran theology, and I think also you could even argue it more than one way in Matthew's context. To make a fairly long story extremely short, I suspect this is God's righteousness. They're not longing to be good. They're longing for God to act. So, God's righteousness in the sense of his tzedakah and mishpat, right, that he's going to perform, as often our local Psalms expert is 4.5 feet away from me, in the Psalter, right? Psalm 71 is a great example. Just read the Septuagint, if you've forgotten the Hebrew. Paralleling salvation and righteousness over and over again. Right? So God's righteousness. They're hungering and thirsting for God to act. Why would they be hungering and thirsting for God to act? Answer, because they know they can't do it themselves. Right? See? So most, and a lot of people, not everyone, break the Beatitudes here. First four, one unit. Second four, another unit. And it works well for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is the again, the human emptiness. So you get these right, blessed to those who have nothing, who can only look to God to do everything, right? Not just for them, but for the world, right? Now there is a shift in verse 7, and you have a more, at least in some of the Beatitudes, the subjects are more active. And I think the way to do this is simply to remember that Jesus is speaking to his disciples. And if you've gotten the first four, you've begun to be changed by that. So, verse 7, blessed the eleemanes, the merciful people, because they themselves will be mercied. Right? Now, of course, this makes Lutherans twitch. But every true Christian can be described as merciful. Right? I mean, this is why we can get away with praying the Lord's Prayer, for crying out loud, if forgiveness is a kind of mercy. Right? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Actually, the reading, that's the King James. You know, the preferred reading in Matthew 6 is actually an aorist, as we forgave. So that makes the problem worse, Bill. Have a nice day. But as the Catechism says, we ask God to forgive us, and we also cheerfully will forgive one another. Why would we do that? Answer, we're the disciples of Jesus. That's why. Now, please notice, Jesus doesn't say, blessed are those who are always and in every way perfectly and in every opportunity merciful as they should be. No. But the believers, the followers of Jesus, can be described as merciful people. And that would be you. Right? And all who trust in the Messiah. So, on the last day, divine mercy comes to them. Verse 8, it makes Lutherans, if verse 7 makes them itch, verse 8 makes them break out in hives. Makarioi hoi katharoite kardia kai atoitan vean apsantai. Blessed are the pure with respect to heart, or the pure in heart, for they themselves will see God. By the way, there's the eschatological connection. The vision of God is the eschatological hope on the last day. Again, you see the side note in Psalm 24. Pretty near everybody agrees that this is a background for it, but nobody works the psalm very hard to try to show what it might mean. Psalm 24, again, I'm fear and trembling with Dr. Seleska so close. It's a liturgical psalm, right? You go up to Zion to worship. Who gets to go up to Zion to worship? Answer, people who have a pure heart. Oh, let's see, wait a minute. Why are they going up to Zion? Because they're sinless? No. Because they always have great motives? No. They're going up to Zion for two reasons. One, they know they're sinful. That's why you go up to the temple, after all, is to get atonement, right? And they know that there's one true God. It's the God of Israel. That's what it means to be pure in heart, is to know the God of Israel. In Matthew, you know the God of Israel by knowing his Son. So to be pure in heart is to acknowledge that this Messiah, this God, is the true God and not some other idol. That's what it means to be pure in heart. So once again, working really hard on Psalm 24, a recently published commentary has a fairly long treatment on this. It's very close to Psalm 51. You know, create in me a pure heart. Very close to that. They will see God, which is a little hard to imagine, but I'm looking forward to it with some fear and trembling. Verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they themselves will be called sons of God. Well, it's very similar to being merciful, right? When you hang around with the Prince of Peace, it sort of can't help but affect you, right? And then finally, blessed are those who have been and are persecuted. De deogmenoi is the perfect participle passive from deoko, which can mean pursue in a neutral sense or even positive, but here as often means persecute. So those who have been persecuted for the sake of, once again, dikaiosine, and I would once again suggest that it's God's righteousness. Those who ally themselves by their faith in Christ with God's ways of salvation will end up getting strife, right? Nevertheless, they can still be regarded as truly, profoundly, eternally blessed because the reign of heaven, which also is persecuted in Jesus, and its blessings belong to them. So that's the basic structure. You have four Beatitudes that emphasize human emptiness in the subject of the main clause. You have four Beatitudes that emphasize the connection with Christ in the subjects of the main clauses. And then you have the longest ninth Beatitude. Matthew loves threes, which is probably why you have nine. And it's a transition into the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, and we can finish off by reading 11 and 12, which essentially simply repeats and expands upon the eighth beatitude. But notice it shifts from third person plural to second person. And then in a kind of a cool, I think it's deliberate, in a cool rhetorical move, now the sermon is second person throughout, mostly plural, occasionally singular, until you get to the end and the concluding section where it shifts back to third person. So it's like you get in through the Beatitudes, and then you track it through now that you've understood the Beatitudes, and then you go back out at the end. So, again, it's all in a fairly recently published, fairly large blue book. Verse 11, blessed are you whenever, hata plus on is hatan, so you expect subjunctive verbs after a form of on, which is what you get. Whenever they revile you and persecute you, all these are aorist, aorist subjunctive, and they say every evil against you, this is a little awkward, by lying, maybe, if you read pseudominoi, on account of me. Verse 12, present imperatives, rejoice and be glad. So we've got Renan and we've got Halal and we've got all kinds of exulting words here, Tim. Because your misthos is big, is much in the heavens. For you're in good company. For thus they persecuted the prophets, the ones who were before you. So again, it's an unbelievably large text. Now, if you're in the habit of preaching for 45 or 50 minutes, you might be able to get a fair amount of it done. Otherwise, I'd pick a theme or two and just kind of run it. Keep your audience in mind, an audience which is probably not thinking eschatologically, so you're going to have to go slow and be gentle. And if they don't get it, that's okay. Because they don't get most of your sermons anyway, right? Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that.
They'll get the illustrations.
They'll get the illustrations. Tomorrow, noon, Hebrew Club, 1 Samuel 18. Thanks a lot.